This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. It's the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of August 19th, 2024. Phoenix has set yet another heat record this summer. We've never had a year with so many overnight low temperatures in the 90s before. As Catherine Davis Young reports, the trend represents a public health challenge.
Before doors even open for overnight heat relief, there's already a crowd of people waiting to get into the Senior Opportunities West Center south of downtown Phoenix. Among those in line is Adeline Goitia. She's 71 and recovering from a stroke. She was supposed to move cross-country recently, but the people who were going to help her couldn't make it to Phoenix.
I got stranded here.
So she's been spending nights at this cooling center.
I came to them and asked, what can I do?
Another regular is George Threadgill. He's been homeless for about 3 years and used to spend summer nights on a park bench.
I say, like, you would have to experience it to know exactly what it feels like.
This summer, he's spent every night here. He likes the peace and quiet, but says the air conditioning doesn't hurt.
It feels rather good in here.
Blanca Corral is here because she and her boyfriend lost their lease on their apartment weeks before they could get into the new place they lined up. To complicate matters, she's pregnant, she says, with translation from a city staffer.
Dios la quiso mandar aquí en el shelter, me la mandó aquí.
God wanted to send baby now, that's okay.
There are no beds at this site, but guests can nap in chairs. And with homeless shelters across the metro area at capacity, demand for those seats this summer has been enormous. The city reports its 5 extended hour heat relief sites have had more than 20,000 visits since May. This is the first summer the city has offered overnight or evening hours at any of its cooling centers, and that timing has proved critical. Summer nights have never been hotter.
We're having more record minimums than we are record maximums.
Randy Cervini is a professor of geographical sciences at ASU. He says the trend is troubling. While daytime highs have climbed gradually over the last couple of decades, Cervini says overnight lows have shot up exponentially.
Back before 2000, we would have basically 5 or less days in which the temperature didn't go below 90.
36 nights this summer have already been that hot, and we could see even more low temperatures in the 90s before the end of August. The urban heat island effect is partly to blame. As Phoenix's population has boomed, the metro area has been paved over with more and more heat-trapping concrete. But Cervini thinks the spike in the number of 90-degree nights over the last few years has more to do with greenhouse gas emissions.
Carbon dioxide traps in the heat that's collected during the day, and therefore we get hotter during the night. So it's one of the clear indications that we have that climate change is going on.
And round-the-clock heat comes with consequences. It stresses vegetation, it drives up demand for electricity, and it creates serious health risks, especially for unsheltered people, says Dr. Nick Staub, assistant medical director for Maricopa County Public Health.
It just doesn't give the body enough time to recover from those really high temperatures that we're experiencing during the day.
Staub's department analyzed 5 years worth of local hospital records and found 90-degree nights resulted in 150% more heat-related illness cases than 80-degree nights. Homeless people faced the greatest risk.
So we also see increased heat-related illness related to those high overnight lows.
The goal of opening the Senior Opportunities West Center and a few other Phoenix heat relief sites at night this year was to reduce heat-related illnesses and deaths, which have soared in the last decade. So far this year, Maricopa County is investigating more than 400 possible heat-related deaths. That is a slight decrease compared to last year, but it's still likely to be one of the deadliest summers on record. And future summers could bring an even more daunting challenge. Nights are likely to be even hotter. Meanwhile, people are still becoming homeless in Maricopa County at about twice the rate homeless people are finding housing. For now, Adeline Goitia, who recently became homeless for the first time at 71, is grateful at least to have had an option for getting inside. I asked what would have happened to her if this cooling center hadn't been available for overnight heat relief.
I hate to think of it, to be honest.
Like others at this heat relief site, she's just trying to get through this summer, one night at a time. Catherine Davis-Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In health news. Last summer, the zone was lined with makeshift structures and tents in a steadily shrinking 15-block radius. A judge's ruling meant the city of Phoenix was responsible for clearing the streets and helping relocate the roughly 800 people living there before the year's end. Almost a year after the last street was cleared, Kirsten Dorman returned to talk to those who remain.
Theo and Sandra are among those still around. For their personal safety in the former encampment, we're only using their first names. They met 2 years ago in the zone when she came by his tent.
It was summertime, 110. She came to see a friend of mine. He wasn't there.
And he helped me out with the situation and everything.
Mm-hmm. Been together ever since, more or less.
Really? Mm-hmm. Homelessness has been worsening over the past decade, but especially over the last several years since the onset of the pandemic, and especially among seniors like Theo and Sandra. Regional HUD Director Jason Pooh says at The Root, it's a matter of funding.
The pandemic era relief measures have run out or are expired. We are seeing a spike in homelessness and housing insecurity, and a record number of people experiencing homelessness for the first time.
Last summer and into the fall, the city of Phoenix was busy working to clear the 15-block encampment. Rachel Milne directs the city's Office of Homelessness Solutions.
But now when you go down to the area, it is very, very different. So you will no longer see tents or makeshift structures.
In fact, the streets are mostly empty, but there are still plenty of people walking around and thousands access services on Key Campus every day. It's a several-acre property that houses over a dozen nonprofits offering everything from overnight beds to dental services. Circle the City's Dr. Rebecca Moran has seen thousands of patients at their downtown location where they offer healthcare services to people in varying stages of homelessness.
There are a lot of services on this campus, which is probably one of the main reasons why the encampment's built up around this campus to begin with.
Moran says they try to provide patients some necessary dignity in the form of clean clothes and a shower, but still.
Discharging a patient after a stroke to home with home health services is one thing, but when home is the street, that's something very different.
While the number of tents on the street has changed, Keys to Change CEO Amy Schwabenlender says the level of need hasn't really.
There's more cooling center, more heat relief stations across the valley, which I think is good to help meet people where they are.
But she says they're still struggling with getting material donations to back that sentiment up. Milne says the city's efforts to offer more resources are at least helping somewhat.
We spent lots of time with all 800 of those individuals, finding out who they were, what their needs were, and trying to offer them diverse solutions in order to help meet their needs. And that was really key in our success.
She says more than 80% of people they engaged accepted services, and nearly 20% out of that group are now permanently housed.
As it was going on, I know I had patients who were worried that, well, this is going to be temporary and I'm going to end up exactly back where I started, who want this to be successful, but had concerns, you know, legitimate concerns of what happens after this is done. Am I going to be forgotten about after that?
Of course, Moran says some solutions aren't going to work for everyone.
I know some people have gotten permanent housing after that. Some people have just moved to other underpasses or to other parts of the city.
Milne says the structured outdoor space her office has introduced has been a safe option for those not ready for or interested in indoor shelter.
We've served over 800 individuals at that location so far. So, and a great majority of them have moved on from that site either to shelter or to housing directly.
Almost a year later, Theo is still working toward housing. He says moving people indoors alone isn't enough.
It's like, you can take the people out the zone, but you can't take the zone out the people. Sometimes.
Right.
They still be in apartments acting like they're out here, and that's why some of them get kicked out.
He says that ever since the judge's order to clear the streets came down, police presence has noticeably picked up. As a result,
we travel light now, nothing heavy, but travel light as you can because you got to move.
But overall, Theo says he and Sandra aren't looking for much.
Get me four walls and a lock door, I'll be cool.
Need some air conditioning? Mm-hmm. Walk around the house, butt naked if you want, just kidding.
Yeah.
Until then, he says, they'll figure it out day by day. Kirsten Dorman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. So how well do you know the Grand Canyon State? KJZZ's A to Z quiz will test your knowledge of all things Arizona, like who or what is Tuba City named after? It's one of this week's questions. Try the KJZZ A to Z quiz at play.kjzz.org. In business news, Phoenix leaders will soon meet behind closed doors to discuss how to respond to the Justice Department's investigation into the city's policing practices. As Christina Estes reports, it's been more than 2 months since the DOJ found Phoenix police used excessive force, acted with bias, and violated constitutional rights.
The DOJ has frequently used consent decrees with other cities. They involve a court monitor and years of federal oversight, a route Interim Chief Michael Sullivan would like to avoid.
I can tell you that under federal oversight, change happens slower.
Sullivan says the department and elected officials are committed to implementing the DOJ's 37 recommendations.
There's many ways that this could end up, and we can't predict where that could be as of today. You know, there could be things that we could report to the Department of Justice. There's been other cities that have done things well short of federal court oversight, but still monitoring with the Department of Justice.
The City Council will discuss options and get legal advice next week. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In politics news, a divided U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 Thursday to allow part of a Republican-supported voter registration law to go into effect in Arizona. From the Politics Desk, Cameron Sanchez reports.
The court ruled that an Arizona law from 2022 requiring people to provide documentary proof of citizenship, like a driver's license, to register to vote is officially enforceable. Going forward, Arizonans will not be able to register to vote using state forms without that proof of citizenship. Arizona Senate President Warren Peterson.
I'm grateful that the Supreme Court weighed in and that they've ruled in our favor and issued the stay so that only citizens will be able to register to vote going forward and voting in our election.
The court did not grant another part of the request by Republicans that Arizonans not be allowed to register to vote in presidential elections or by mail without providing proof of citizenship. The court's decision will not affect any Arizonans who are already registered to vote. Cameron Sanchez, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In education news, the Scottsdale Unified School District has adopted a new policy regarding its booster organizations. As Bridget Dowd reports from the Education Desk, this follows a scandal at one of its middle schools.
Earlier this month, a Cocopah middle school parent went missing and later turned herself in after she was accused of stealing more than $30,000 from the school's Association of Parents and Teachers. On Tuesday, the district's governing board unanimously approved a new policy to develop a uniform set of procedures for those organizations. Before the vote, board member Julie Sanowski noted that the idea was introduced in April, but a vote on it was delayed several times.
And let's be clear, had the board acted in April when the administrative recommendation been put forward, perhaps we could have disrupted what happened at Cocopah.
School site administrators, athletic directors, and others will come up with a list of best practices to guide those involved with booster organizations. Bridget Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In Tribal Natural Resources, which is supported in part by a grant from the Katina Foundation. This week, the Bureau of Land Management began accepting nominations to form an advisory committee on managing Arizona's latest national monument. Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
The 15 members are expected to represent a mix of stakeholders, including tribes. They will provide input to BLM and the U.S. Forest Service on how to manage the nearly 1 million acres known as Baj Nawajo Itaktutveni, or the ancestral footprints of the Grand Canyon National Monument. It's home to more than 3,000 known cultural and historic sites, including 12 properties listed on the National Register of Historic Places. The agency's announcement comes a week after Arizona's Attorney General asked the Forest Service to conduct a new environmental impact study for the Pinon Plain uranium mine nestled within the National Monument. Gabriel Pietrazio, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In Fronteras News,
Sedona is launching a new initiative to alleviate traffic on its roads by offering an Uber-like system for its shuttle services. From the Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Michel Marisco reports on the project that starts next Thursday.
For $2 and just one for seniors, folks will be able to use a cell phone app to call for a shuttle to come pick them up. The on-demand public transit allows riders to summon a shuttle at various stops throughout the city, and it's designed not only for locals but for tourists. The so-called Sedona Shuttle Connect will also intersect with the city's trailhead shuttles that bring hikers out to the start of popular trails. It's the latest in a series of transportation projects in Sedona. A nearly 300-car parking garage broke ground this week. That project cost more than $17 million and is expected to take a year. Michel Marisco, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
And finally, from KJZZ's original production, The Show, co-host Mark Brody kicks off a new series called Last Resorts, with a look back at the start of Arizona's resort industry.
Travel and tourism have been big industries in the Phoenix area for decades. Winter-weary East Coasters and Midwesterners are just those looking for something different, headed west in search of adventure or maybe just some sunshine. A group called the Arizona Development Board estimated tourism accounted for $160 million to the state in 1954. That's nearly $2 billion in today's dollars. More recently, the Arizona Office of Tourism reports the travel industry brought more than $28 billion in direct spending to the state. And a lot of those visitors to the valley over the years have stayed in resorts. A number of those early spots have since been closed and torn down, but not all of them. Many still in operation have been hosting travelers for many years, while others have been open for many fewer years. Today, we're kicking off a new series here on the show looking at the history and future of resorts and the valley as a resort community. We're calling it Last Resorts. Over the next several weeks, we'll travel from Paradise Valley to Litchfield Park and visit some of the valley's oldest and newest resorts and hear how they've impacted the region from art and architecture to how people all over the world view the West.
From all over the world, come visitors to relax and rest in the sun-drenched desert of Arizona. Dude ranches, great resort hotels, inns.
Scottsdale is delightful and clean and new.
Phoenix, a simply splendid city. Don't worry for a minute about a place to stay.
There is a ruggedness here, a loveliness here, that combines into a package of colorful memories. History, wildlife, entertainment, grandeur, they're all here awaiting you on your Arizona holiday.
And we start our series with a look back to some of the earliest resorts, both here in the valley and across Arizona. To help do that, I'm joined by Claire McWilliams, an assistant teaching professor at ASU, where she teaches classes on tourism development and management. And Claire, the state has had tourism as a big part of its economy for a long time. Resorts and hotels, of course, have been a big part of that. From your perspective, where did all that start?
I think the story is the same as it would be in modern day, which is, you know, Arizona has its five C's, cattle, citrus, copper, and cotton, but then there's climate. That's a C. We have been a winter escape climate for a long, long time. And then our other C is the canyon. We have a celebrated natural wonder in this state, and people have been wanting to see it for a long, long time. And that's, in my opinion, kind of the birth of part of our industry is at the canyon, with the Grand Canyon Hotel being built in 1892. And I want to say that lodging kind of always mirrors whatever the attractions that are being developed are and what the transportation innovations are of the day.
So at the Grand Canyon, for example, that would be natural wonders and railroads, right?
Absolutely. So if you think about, let's say, the late 1800s, there were these magazines being published like Scribner's and National Geographic, and they painted this beautiful picture of the canyon, maybe the Southwest at large, if you will. And that captured the imaginations of people who, for the first time, had time and money to participate in leisure away from home. And yes, railways come along. They make Arizona accessible. And you have early hoteliers and entrepreneurs like Fred Harvey. I don't know if you've heard of his Harvey Girls, but he set up shop in the 1880s along the Santa Fe Railway route and started employing females as providing great service in his hotels and restaurants along the way.
So At what point and how did all of this migrate south? Because the Phoenix area has also for a very long time, probably not as long as the Grand Canyon, but for a very long time, been a community that is really, that for which tourism is very important and has had a lot of hotels and resorts.
Well, kind of moving south with the creation of the national park system and the fact that we have so many national parks in our state, again, coupling that with the weather, I think it made perfect sense that tourism would start to move into the valley, people wanting to explore during those winter escape months and finding their way to other attractions in doing so. I think the fact that we have another sea, which is culture, and we have this access here in the valley, our proximity to Mexico, our 22 federally recognized Native American tribes in the state, there's just a fertile place in all areas of the state for tourism to grow. And it certainly did here in the valley. I think of some really cool hotels historically, like the Hotel San Carlos, which opened up in 1928. I actually see it out the window of my downtown campus at ASU. The Wigwam out in Litchfield Park, or the Arizona Biltmore, which were both opened in 1929. And then maybe another reason for the valley gaining a lot of resort-style lodging is golf.
Yeah. When did a lot of these places start popping up? You mentioned, for example, the Wigwam and the Biltmore in the late 20s and the San Carlos, but, you know, there are were a ton of resorts that came after that. Was there sort of a heyday for them?
I think in every decade, you can find some interesting types of resorts that became part of the narrative of Arizona. And some I can think of would be like in the 1930s. That's when Camelback Inn, which is now a JW Marriott, and then the beautiful Hermosa Inn that opened up in 1936. So that decade saw some really beautiful kind of iconic Arizona properties. And then, you know, you can go into the whole Route 66 component. That's the Motor Hotel, which is just a portmanteau. That's what motel is a motor hotel. And, you know, after World War II, people were road tripping all over the state.
At what point did resorts become a place to go, like in and of themselves, almost regardless of where they were, as opposed to like going to a resort in Phoenix and then sort of exploring around the area?
I think that's been in development for a long time, and maybe Arizona's early to figuring out that you don't have to just stay at a place and then go elsewhere for your fine dining, entertainment, et cetera, that you can do that where you are, if you're in the right resort. So we don't have to look at modern day to see that. You can look back at the history of the Biltmore, other places, and see that those places were iconic attractions of their own. So I think it's not about when they started, it's just how they ramped up to the reputation that they have today.
So when you look at how resorts now market themselves and the kinds of amenities they offer, how much of it is about trying to keep people who are staying there at that property versus, you know, saying, hey, if you come to Phoenix, you can go, you know, see X, Y, and Z and do this and that. And then, you know, maybe come back for the spa and a round of golf and a nice meal in the evening.
Well, here's another great example is the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act of 1988. These are properties that there's a lot of hotel properties that are now attached to casinos. So there's a unique opportunity to make everything that you want or need in one space, starting with gaming and then moving your way out from there. You could look at places like where Talking Stick is, the Salt River Pima Maricopa Reservation near Scottsdale. That's kind of a lodging corridor, an entertainment corridor, if you will, whether it's wanting to do privately owned attractions or spring training. It's all in one spot. So I think that it's easier now for hotels to position themselves to be not only a lodging place, but one where you can catch a show and do a variety of entertaining things while you're there, not just stay.
How important are resorts to Arizona's economy and Arizona's tourism economy in 2024?
Well, I think COVID showed us how important they are, because when it all shut down, it was rough. It was kind of a horrific toll short term on our industry with hotel closures and financial losses, and really, from my perspective, a loss of talent that we still feel today. So I think having things taken away is the first way of really seeing how important they are to our economy. 2019, the year before we had COVID, was a record-breaking year in Arizona, $25 billion in direct spending. That's a figure from the Arizona Office of Tourism. So it is really important. And I would like to say to you that just like tourism disappearing overnight is a nightmare, I also think that unmanaged tourism growth can also be a nightmare. So I think all of our resort community, our lodging, and all the other sectors of tourism really need to work on finding balance and finding out what our carrying capacity is to make sure that we have the right types of tourism and the right types of projects developed versus just unchecked tourism growth, which can lead to places that I don't know if the Valley would really like to go in.
I'm curious what the future for resorts in the Valley looks like to you. I mean, we just had, for example, Caesars opening its facility in Scottsdale. The first, you mentioned casinos, the first one that didn't have a casino under the Caesars brand.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to go there with my students and take a tour of it when it opened. And it's an amazing property. What it looks like on the inside compared to what you see on the outside, you're just, you don't expect what you see when you walk in there. So yeah, I think a variety of models are waiting. There's a lot of projects that are waiting to happen that are getting ready to open. So I don't see any stop to it in the near future in terms of projects. Also interested in the partnerships that are out there, the kind of like sports tourism, for example, lots of interesting partnerships happening there.
Claire McWilliams is an assistant teaching professor at ASU, where she teaches classes on tourism development and management. Next week, as part of our Last Resort series, we'll check out a collection of historic postcards depicting a part of Phoenix that set the stage for the region becoming a resort community.
Don't you just love new series? And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation and Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation and Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.